I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. We've got a lot of new listeners who are joining the Project Recovery family. And on Facebook and Instagram, a lot of people have been asking me, how come this is and why are we doing what we're doing? Well, it kind of all started with me. So for those of you who are just joining our feed and our podcast, here's a little bit about my story. Casey Scott here, Project Recovery. I've got my co-host here, Matt Woolley.
How you doing, Casey?
I'm doing great. I mean, all things considered, yes. This is a podcast all about recovery and the world of recovery.
Addiction and recovery, right?
Yeah, and I'm kind of the catalyst into it because of all I've been through.
You're the reason we're here.
But no. The reason I'm here is because I want to share my story,
right,
and talk about the things that I learned in detox, rehab, and 25-some-odd years of partying.
Yeah.
And it was a world that I was kind of thrown into. But to be honest, the one that I kind of walked into myself. And so to get started, let's just talk about my story, if you don't mind, for a minute.
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, I've been doing TV and radio for 25 years. And let's just say, when I was introduced into this business, I was told, whenever we see Casey, whenever we hear Casey, we want to think of fun. We want to think of fun. That's what it's about. If we go to Casey, he's going to have something fun for us.
Who's telling you this?
Well, it was producers. It was program directors. It was hosts of television shows.
So they're trying to kind of get you to set up your early career persona.
Yeah. And so, and that's exactly what it is it's a persona and it's a character. Now, it's a character based on myself, and sometimes it's exaggerated. Sometimes, it's
by nature, you're a fun guy and you like to have fun, but this is kind of playing a persona for the audience.
Maybe. Now, the great thing about me, if I could tell you, the thing about Casey is that if it was good and I did what I was supposed to, good job, Casey. You were supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If I fail, it's usually magical and it's fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I had one of these jobs that was, if I did my job right, I was supposed to.
Yeah.
If I did it wrong, it was usually comical and there was something to laugh about.
Kind of like those kids that do the skateboard fails.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah. But every once in a while they make it and you go, oh, wow, that was cool too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Both ends are great.
Yeah. Either way, we were good.
Yeah.
And so I started in radio at the age of 23. And I always wanted to be in TV and radio because that's what my dad did. And I can tell you, in fifth grade, you know, when you're sent home and you're supposed to do a report on what you want to be when you grow up, the next day everybody comes back and everyone had doctors, lawyers, nurses, pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And on my paper, my teacher goes, who's that? And I go, that's my dad. And he goes, you want to be your dad? I said, yeah. I want to be my dad when I grow up because
cool.
I think my dad was the coolest guy ever.
Yeah.
And so I always wanted to be my dad.
Yeah.
And so he did TV. He did radio. Up in college, up at Utah State, I was in a fraternity and I would DJ parties and I would DJ clubs. And when I started DJing, I was like, this is cool because you were at the party.
Mm-hmm.
But you were kind of like the conductor of the party.
You're the MC.
Yeah. You could kind of take these guys for a ride, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I could sit there and go, all right, if I play this song, whoop, there it is. This place is going to go crazy.
Yeah.
And if I see a girl that's cute, I'm going to play this song because I know how to dance. I can go out there and do this. And so it was fun, and I really started to enjoy it. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe this music thing is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of college, I came down, and I made a tape that sounded like I was already on the radio. It was for a station called Star, Star 102.7. And so,
was that a fictional station?
No, it was actually a station down here.
Oh, okay.
And so I tried to get this tape out, and I went over to the Star Studios, and they said, "We're not hiring." And I said, "Well, let me be a salesperson, and I'll do that until a job opens." And this guy goes, "Let me get this right. I'm going to take all my time and effort and teach you how to sell, but as soon as an on-air job comes, you're going to leave it." And me, being naive, I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "No." He goes, "If you want to be in radio, you want to be in TV, then you go do that.
Yeah.
Don't waste my time and don't waste your time."
Yeah. So it's pretty good advice.
It was great advice. Yeah. And so, okay. And so then I had a friend over at a radio group called Citadel back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so, and my dad did advertising. And so I went over to talk to this guy.
I was going
to
ask what your dad does. You didn't
Yeah, he did advertising. He owned an agency. He was the little guy in the furniture in the R.C. Willie commercials in the 1980s.
Nice.
I did Associated Foods, Snow Basin. Okay. I mean, he's done a bunch of movies. Apple Dumpling Gang 2.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Reuben and Ed.
Reuben and Ed.
Yeah, he's in Reuben and Ed.
That's actually a really good show.
Yeah, he gets his nose broken by Howard Hessman.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're celebrity royalty.
Yeah, he's got libraries full of leather-bound books. I've seen him eat a whole wheel of cheese once.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it is impressive. So I went over to Citadel, and we made a tape that sounded like I was over there, and I was gunning to be on the end. And I do that, and back then I used to smoke cigarettes, and this guy was going out back, and I said, "Hey, do you mind if I join you?" So I go out back and light up a cigarette, and I'm talking to this guy, and I'm like, "Hey, what's your name?" And he goes, "Dom." I go, "Your name's Dom?" And he goes, "Yeah, Dom Casual." I said, "Hey, what's going on, Dom?" And I was smoking a cigarette, and he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to get a job, on the radio." He goes, "Do you want to be overnights?" I said, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, you work from 12 to 6 in the morning." I said, "I've never been on the air." And he goes, "Well, that's where you learn." Okay. So I came in from a cigarette, and I was the overnight guy on the end.
Very nice.
And so I'm doing that.
And I think listeners to our podcast might remember
Dom. Yeah. And Dom Casual and Biff Raff and Jimmy Chunga and Barb and, Mike Lindsay and John Smith, Kerry Bushman. I mean, it was a fraternity.
It
was cool. And it was a great introduction.
And tobacco finally paid off.
Yeah. It did. Yeah. Big money. And so I got paid in CDs and pizzas from $5 Pizza.
Nice.
Yeah, it was good. But then I met Junga and I met Mister and I was their producer and I did a lot of work for them. And that's where the Casey persona really kind of started to take hold. And so I've never been shy. I'm not afraid to go in front of a group
of
people.
Definitely not shy.
Not afraid to knock on someone's door or do this. So I, when they needed somebody to do that, I was the guy. I was like, "Yeah, sure, I'll do it."
So just so everybody knows, you were outside the studio a lot.
Yeah.
You were running around on location.
On location.
Doing gags.
Yeah.
And
running the front runner. So here's an interesting story real quick. This is probably the first time that I ever thought I was cool. So we had these tickets to a concert and a bunch of back-to-school stuff because it was back-to-school. I used to have sideburns down. They were more like lamb chops, both my ears pierced, long blonde hair. And the job was, they said, go pick a school and walk around. And if you walk up to people and they can answer the question, you give them back-to-school tickets or back-to-school stuff or tickets. So I'm down at BYU, and I'm walking around. And all of a sudden, I'm just inundated with people. We are huge down in Utah County. Yeah. And people are coming up to me, and I get on the cell phone afterwards, and I'm telling Chunga. I was like, "Chunga, man, everybody knows who I am. This is great. And he's like, "Well, keep going. And I'm like, yes. And I run out of all my stuff in the first break. And afterwards, I'm talking to this guy, and I was like, "Hey, how did you guys know who I was and that I was down here?" And he goes, "It was pretty easy." And I go, "How?" And he goes, "You're the only one smoking on campus."
Two earrings and a cigarette.
Yeah.
You can stand out.
Probably wasn't hard to find out there on the campus at BYU. You know what I mean?
For sure.
And so that kind of just fed into it. And then so.
But what's fun about that is you were willing to kind of go out and be yourself anywhere you were. And, I think got real positive attention for that.
Yeah. I wasn't unapologetic. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, so I was just saying, "Hey, this is me."
Yeah.
And so in my career, although it's been a character of myself, it's always been based in really who I am and what I'm about and what I believe in. And I've always been honest and as much as I can with the public, with the fans, and with everybody.
Yeah.
So I did that for about 15 years, and then I moved into TV, and TV kind of had the same kind of deal. It was like, hey, you know, news is bad, and we don't want to have everyone to always have bad
news.
It's
kind of a if you consume too much of the real world based news, it can be kind of depressing.
We want you to be a break in people's morning. We want you to do community stuff. We want you to showcase businesses that might not have the money to advertise. So let's send you out and, you know, kind of follow in the footsteps of Ally McKay, who's my predecessor, in Big Buddha. And so we do that. And so the thing is about from going from radio to TV, anytime, whether it's my family, my ex-wife, or anybody, we had a hard rule. If we weren't getting along or my kids were acting up and somebody came up and said, hey, Casey, I just want to tell you, I love you on TV. I love it and that. Everybody snapped to.
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody, meaning your kids.
My kids, my wife, played nice.
Because, so you guys had this conversation at home?
Yeah, because I said, hey, listen, you know,
so you're out at the Walmart and you're dragging your kid down the aisle because they're screaming.
Yeah, back to school.
Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, or me,
because we've all been there.
Yeah, or yeah, me and the ex-wife are fighting. You know what I mean? And I was like, you know, they expect me to be happy. They do this,
right?
And
right.
So there became this pattern of always being happy and always wanting to, when people see you, go, hey, that guy's fun. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But throughout that whole time,
but that kind of creates this situation where you're never off. You're always kind of on if you're out in public, right?
I would be sitting there in bed with my ex-wife, and she would say, "You're not on TV. Quit being funny," or. You know, but that's the thing.
That's why I'm laughing, because that's tough.
But my brain is now hardwired to always looking at the bright side of something, always trying to get the laugh, always trying to reach out there and make someone's day. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what's going on with me. My job is to make you happy. My job is to make you laugh. Yeah. And a lot of this is self-imposed. I mean, that I put upon myself because this was the persona and this is what I'm believing and this is what I'm doing. But a little bit was because of the job. You know what I mean?
And I think your job is dependent on interacting well with people, which I think you do naturally really well. You're really good off the cuff and you're able to joke around and laugh. But like you said, that became kind of your day in, day out, even when you're with your kids. So it's probably hard to switch out of that being kind of centered around, well, how do I feel about things?
Right? You know, and it goes back to the radio and TV days. We'd sit in meetings and have consultants come in, and they would sit down and they would tell you, and they go, listen, people are tuning in to have an escape from their life, from their reality. They're going to a job they don't like. You're sitting here playing music and telling jokes. People are envious of your situation. What they don't want to hear is that you're going through a divorce or that you're having a bad day.
Right.
People don't want to tune in to hear you having a bad day. If they want to hear a bad day, they'll look in the mirror or they'll, you know what I mean? So it was like always trying to be upbeat. And now we worked in a radio station where there was three of us in the room at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get three people always happy, always at the same time,
oh, yeah.
A little unrealistic, but that was the job. That's mm-hmm. what you signed up for, 4 hours a day. And there's some people that are really good about being able to do that, and mm-hmm. I like to pride myself that I was one of them.
Yeah.
Regardless of what was happening, I knew that for those 2 hours, those 4 hours, I could give you what you want.
Well, and just, you know, from the listener side of it, as a commuter driving into Salt Lake, going to work, going up to the hospital, getting ready for my day, working with patients, I listened to that particular morning show, and it was brightening. It was nice to be able to hear you guys joking and laughing and kind of wondering what kind of shenanigans is Casey going to be up to this morning. And people arrive at work feeling a little boost, a little lift, even though they may have kind of a heavy work day ahead of them. So it's all, and I know you knew that. That was part of the job.
And that was one of the benefits of the job that I really love and is the fact that you would get these emails or, you know, someone would write you a letter because back in the days, of, you know, it was early infancy.
Well, now
emails.
What's a letter?
No, yeah, a letter. But they would say, listen, you really helped this morning show. You don't realize how much it helped us out.
Yeah.
How much it got us through a dark point. You know, I was driving my kid to chemo every day and this was a way to make him laugh. And this was the only part of the day that he laughed. And there was and there was a responsibility that you felt that you wanted to make sure you gave him those.
And we've talked about the fact that that means a lot to you.
It means the world to me. That's why I want to do this. That's why I want to be honest and let everybody know what's going on. Because I still love my job. I still love that I'm able to do this. And I want to be honest and let everybody know what's kind of going on and kind of set the scene to where what happened to me happened to me. And if this helps by sharing it, then that's exactly what I want to do.
I think it absolutely does and will, because of all those years you've built a lot of trust with people here in the area that have listened to you and have, you know, enjoyed kind of being your friend even though they've never met you.
And I consider you friends, and I consider them friends, and I'm a good
guy. Well, we're actually friends.
Yeah.
You and I.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure I was okay.
Yeah. No, you're in.
Okay,
you're in.
All right.
But I was a good guy with some bad habits, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that on the other side of this break.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
All right, welcome back. It's Casey Scott and Dr. Matt Lilly. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Having a good time.
Part deux. Are you ready?
That was very French of you.
Of the Casey story.
Yeah.
So as I left you last time, I was saying a good guy with bad habits.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always, you know, drank. I mean, I started when I was 16. And we're going to get to when it became a problem here in the end. Although I can tell you that it was probably a problem throughout the whole time.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the drinking you did in high school was like a lot of teenagers. It was sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
And you weren't drinking heavily, were you?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was drinking, but I think it was more fun-based drinking,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, at a party or that
yeah,
kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, I've been in the industry 24 years. We talked about radio. We talked about TV. And we talked about kind of that I was always on.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what was going on, I was always on. If I was on the TV, I was on. If I was on radio, I was on. If I was at the Maverick, I was on. If I was at my kid's school.
You kind of, because it was a public persona on the radio and TV, then when you were in public, you kind of felt like you still had to be you, right?
Well, because I always hated, especially being in radio and TV, when you met some of your idols and you realized that they were jerks.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was talked about way more than if it was a good guy. If you met an idol and were someone that you liked and idolized and they were a jerk, you told everybody and anybody that would listen.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I had a weird experience in the parking garage at the Gateway. Not what you think. And there was a on-air.
Wait, what was I thinking?
I don't know. We'll talk about it later. But there was an on-air personality person on TV there just, you know, doing his thing. And I was about to point out to my son, like, oh, look, that's, you know, so-and-so. And I, you know, that's about all I was interested in. But, you know, hey, that's, you know. And at that same time, this, like, younger person came up and asked for, like, an autograph or something. And he blew that person off and kind of said something rude and walked off. And I remember thinking, wow. I can't believe he'd act that way. And then later, as I do, I was thinking about that a lot. And I thought, well, you know, he's just a regular guy. And he probably had whatever going on in his own life. And he wasn't horrible to the person, but he definitely blew him off. And it was all kind of a surprise. And I thought, you know, I remember having that thought. It would be tough to have to be on all the time. Even, who knows, maybe he had just had a family issue going on and he couldn't really be in his own head because somebody was coming up and talking to him.
You know, and that's the tough part about this job, because it's hard to play the poor me card when your job is to tell jokes, to interview celebrities, to do fun stuff, to get a front row at some of the greatest events. It's hard to say.
Hang out with bands.
Yeah, it's hard to say poor me. I mean, it's hard to say poor me, because people are going to go, wait a minute, you poor me, I'm pouring concrete and it's 30 below outside, yeah. You know, or I'm, you know, and so, I mean, it's perspective, and it's all perspective. Yeah. And yeah, of course, they are allowed to have a bad day, but you get into a mindset where you go, okay, I don't want somebody to go, I was at my kid's school and that guy from, you know, yeah.
Casey from TV was...
was there. Yeah. And you know what? He wasn't funny. As a matter of fact, he was downright rude.
Yeah.
And maybe I wasn't...
because you're right. Bad news travels faster than good news.
Yeah. And so you get into that mindset and you do it. And I remember one time I was working at that radio station. I was working at the end. Mm-hmm. And it was right before the 2002 Olympics. And we had no snow. And the whole town was going crazy. Yeah. We've got the whole world coming here and we don't have any snow. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And so this is the fun part about the job. So we sit around. Well, what can we do? Well, we came up with this idea. We're going to burn these skis. You know what I mean? In effigy. And I hope I used that word.
Yeah. It's a sacrifice.
A sacrifice, if
you will.
Right.
You're sacrificing to the snow gods.
Yes.
These skis.
Yes. Bring
Please
us some snow. Please.
Right.
We need it now.
Yep.
So it was me and John Smith, who's our producer on this show. And we're out there.
John was there with you?
Yeah, he was out there. And okay. So here's the deal. I'll just set the visuals for you. We had two pairs of skis formed a pyramid.
Nice.
And around them, we had in some old boots that we got at the DI. Put some tin foil on top of it, okay? I've got a furry $600 jacket that some place up in Park City lent me for this, because we got the news coming. This is going to be cool.
So they wanted to show their product.
Yeah, it was a spider jacket. Awesome. I still got it at home, and it's singed. I swear, and I won't throw it away.
Yeah.
Well, because I'm a little bit
spoiler
of a
spoiler alert. But
yeah. And so we're doing that, and I'm on the phone, and I'm talking to the host, and John Smith's out there. I got the TV on, and John's job was to go back there and pour some gas on it so it would light, because we
on
wanted
the
to make
skis?
On the skis. Yeah. So they would go, you know, this big deal. Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking to the TV, John Smith's back there dumping gasoline on there. I don't realize how much gas he's dumping on there, but I guess he dumped a lot. Was it a full cup?
It was a gallon. It
yeah.
was a gallon.
So
gasoline.
He dumped it on there, and I'm talking to the TV, and they go, okay, we got to end this. And so the end's going to be go back and just light this thing on fire.
They right? actually said when they're filming, like when you go back and watch, it was on the news, like it made national news. And when you go back and watch, Rod Decker actually says, notice how much gasoline is being poured on the skis.
Yeah, and I didn't notice it because I'm into the TV doing my job.
That's where he got his nickname, Go Big or Go Home.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I turn around and I light these skis on fire. Whew, this pluff, poom, whatever it is of gas.
Well, it was all those fumes were just hanging in the air.
Next thing you know, no eyebrows, no bangs. My coat is singed. I'm still on the radio talking to the host. He's like, so tell me what's going on. And I said, dude, I'm on fire. And he goes, okay, so what's going on? I go, dude, I'm on fire. This bit is over.
Yeah.
And so I take the phone and I shut it off. So I'm in the bathroom. I'm splashing cold water on my face. I'm looking in the mirror.
Trying to figure out how bad the damage is, right?
Yeah, I can't see eyebrows. Someone's pounding on the door. I'm like, I'm in here. Oh, hold on. Pounding on the door. Okay. Finally open the door. Host comes in.
And he goes, you were on the phone with before?
Yeah, I was on the phone with. And he goes, just so we're clear, the bit's over when I say the bit's over.
Oh, wow.
And I said, look at my face. I was on fire. What else did you want?
Yeah.
You know, and That's incredible. That's the kind of pressure, you know, that
he wanted you to keep going with that bit, even though you're on fire.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Or just keep going, or tell them that I'm on fire.
Make the fire funny somehow.
But just go, look, I'm on fire, and maybe go into detail. But at that point, I'm in panic mode, you know. And I'm like, you know, like I said, all these things are going through. I can't afford a $600 jacket. I don't have eyebrows. I'm not even good with an eye pencil. I don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, at my point, I'm thinking, you're
total crisis mode.
Yeah, this is when you go to Tintin, which is the longest song, so you can go out and make sure everybody's okay.
Right, right.
You know, kiss me. And so, you know, and so there was kind of things like that.
Well, I mean, how'd you process that afterwards? Like that whole experience of we're not over till I say we're over.
I'm new and I'm kind of going, well, maybe this is what you do. And okay. I don't know what it is, but I've always been a guy that says, well, even when I do TV or radio, they go, let's practice. And I go, I'd rather not. And they go, why?
I know that about you.
And I go, because if we practice, we're not going to get an honest, genuine reaction. Mm-hmm. And if I do it, this is going to be great. And if I don't, then I'm going to play with it and go off of it.
Yeah.
One time I was working for Channel 2, and I was riding a bull.
A real bull?
A real bull. And the bull turned around and hit me and the rodeo clown, and the rodeo clown kneed me in the face and threw me up in the air.
Oh, my God.
And the camera's rolling the whole time. I get down. I still stay on the air. You can YouTube this. Casey Scott rides a bull twice and check it out. And I go back and I lock myself in the pen and I stayed on the whole time. And I said,
are you serious?
And I said, I'm done. I'm out. And we've got to send this back to you guys. And they go, are you going to ride the bull again? I go, I don't think so. And so called me right after. They're like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm okay. They go, why don't you just go home for the day? So I think that's going to be good. I had a Gorbachev sized bruise on my butt. Was bad. And then all of a sudden I'm laying there and Channel 5 calls. And I go, you know, I work for Channel 2, right? And they go, yeah, but did they make you ride the bull? And I was like, no. But Channel 5 did a story on Channel 2 of me riding a bull. You know,
drama.
So what I'm saying is that it all seemed to work out sometime, you know, and I'm game for it.
Yeah.
But didn't you break your back once doing a bit on a snowmobile?
No, I didn't break my back, but I did. I got a fake hip. I've got stitches. Right. I mean, I'm Johnny Knoxville without the cash.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so, but what it did is it set a precedent. And it wasn't so much on the stations so much as me and myself of always just trying to go above and beyond.
And that's what I mean by, like, how do you process that? Because what I hear you saying on the one hand is that you're kind of proud of yourself for being able to get back on the bull. Like, you're the guy that'll go out there and do these things and ride with it. But even when you do that, sometimes it's not always appreciated.
I think it's appreciated, but when
you're not able to have your own moment with it if it doesn't really go well. Like, for example, if you got caught on fire.
Yeah. You know, and so there was times like that. But then it kept going, and this thing kept getting bigger and bigger. And so I was sucked in, and so I didn't know how to get out of it. And then all of a sudden, you're tasked with being funny every morning.
Yep.
And then I get kids, I get married, I want to come home, and it's hard to talk to somebody about this because my friends think I only work 7 minutes a day because that's all I'm on TV.
Right.
Friends and family, my brothers, think that I don't really work because they don't realize.
Because they just see you having fun.
Yeah.
That's all they see.
And over 25 years, I've cultivated this personality and I've cultivated, you know, my humor and I've done all this. And it's hard to tell somebody, hey, man, I'm not doing good. And I came from an era where you don't tell people that you're not doing good. You buck up and you do it and you get back on that bull. And so every time that something bad would happen, you know, my ex-wife, God bless her, I mean, I would try to tell her, but she doesn't understand. That's why when you see a group of radio DJs, you know, that group of, you know, is geese, you know, but a group of comedians is called a bitter because, you know what I mean? Because they can talk to each other. They understand, you know what I mean? Although it is a fun job, it still is a job. And you have to get up and do these things every morning and you got to bring your A game. And
I think people listening to this can kind of wrap their mind around the fact that you literally have to be on when you're working. Like, you're on. You're entertaining the whole time. And the reality is nobody wakes up feeling like be consistently in a good mood every day.
No. Right? But it was a bar that I set for myself that I gave it everything I could to do it. And what I didn't realize of over 20 years of doing this, I lost what was important to me. It wasn't so much of what's Casey feeling or how's this going. It's what are you going to do tomorrow? What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And so I never internalized my feelings. I never, you know what I mean? I just wouldn't give them the time of day, if you will. Or if I did, you know what would make that go away? A beer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what it would do. And so, so I'm doing all this. I'm on the top of the world, I feel, and I'm having a great time. Accolades when you're out in public and all this stuff. But you come home and you feel alone.
And I think part of, and you can tell me if this doesn't fit for you or not, but I think part of a job like that is how you feel about yourself. Is the only thing you think about yourself is, I must be doing well if I'm entertaining the other people. Like, the reflection of yourself is, okay, I'm doing well when they're laughing, when the bit's going well. But beyond that, not spending a lot of time thinking about your own feelings and how you feel about where you're at, where Casey's at.
Yeah. You know, you enter into Facebook and the social media world, okay? You get 10. Man, that was funny. That was great. That becomes white noise. You get one guy that says you're an idiot, or I can't believe you did this, or I can't believe you'd put this guy on there. Mm-hmm. And instead of thinking of the 10 people who said nice things about you, mm-hmm. I'm going to spend all day long thinking about this guy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I'm giving this guy this much power, but I'm giving him the power. Yeah. And it's now consuming my thoughts. Yeah. Why doesn't he like me? Why doesn't he love me? Everybody else seems to love me, but this guy doesn't do it. Does this guy either know something that they don't know, or is this guy just being a jerk?
Well, he was just being a jerk probably. But our brains are tuned into negative news more easily than positive news. And that's actually an evolutionary mechanism. Our brains tend to pick up on the negative much more clearly and astutely than the positive, because it could be a danger that we need to avoid. That's just kind of how the brain works. So that's a very common phenomenon I've talked to other people in the media about, that they'll have 100-to-1 or 1,000-to-1, but that one negative comment will sometimes consume all their attention.
And so that's what's starting to consume some of my attention. And then you throw in the fact of being married with 3 kids in life and all of that stuff. All of a sudden, life gets real hectic. Now, I'm not telling anybody out there something they don't already know, but it does. But the thing is that it affects me just like it would affect anybody else. And so throughout this time, I'm self-medicating when I'm down. I'm trying to be happy. I'm doing all this stuff.
Or even just unwinding. Like, that's a lot of energy you put out during the day, and coming home and unwinding, unfortunately, it was, with a beer.
But I also felt like if I was going to go out and have beers with my friends or go out with parties, that I had to be the life of the party.
Right.
And at that point, my ex-wife's like, I don't want to go. I like you to be with you. I don't want to go do this. I don't want to go be a part of the Casey show. I see the Casey show. I want Casey.
Yeah.
And, that's a part of the reason we got divorced, and drinking was a part of it. Just having different beliefs and goals in life was a part of it, and all that stuff. So throughout this time, I'm drinking, I'm fighting with my wife, I'm trying to figure life out, and then it starts to go south. And I sit down and I talk with my wife, and she goes, I'm done. I'm out.
Mm.
And this goes on for, a year, 12 months,
Do you think the two of you grew apart in part because of the Casey show?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think it was that. I think you grow up. I think you evolve and mature. And I think there was just a bunch of stuff that all came together. And I think at one point we were married for 12 or 13 years. I think some people just roll over and look at that spouse and go, they either go, this is it,
mm-hmm.
or they go, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And go, yeah, either I'm in mm-hmm. for the long haul, or I think I want something else and I want something different.
Yeah.
And that she wanted something different. And I don't begrudge her that. I mean, because listen, this is her life too.
Sure.
And I don't want anyone to stay because out of obligation.
Right.
You know what I mean? We only get one of these. Let's be happy. And if you're not happy, I truly want you
Did
to be happy.
Did you ever feel that way too?
I think so. Yeah. You know what I mean? I think certain things, you know, without getting into much or without having her say in it, I think, you know, yeah. There was definitely some of that.
It was kind of to some degree, a mutual thing.
Yeah, and I think I was self-sabotaging, making it easy, and then you get into this vicious cycle where you're just drinking, and at first you're drinking to forget your problems, and then the next day you're drinking just to feel normal, and then you just get in this circle that you can't get out. So flash forward, I get a divorce, I lose a job from drinking.
The TV job.
Yeah. I lose, you know, respect for myself, respect for colleagues. I had some close coworkers leave. And I'm not giving you excuses. By any means, what I did was not anyone else's fault but my fault. It was me. It was totally me 100% and how I dealt with it. But you're never taught really how to deal with feelings. You're never, you know, life is kind of write it as you go. And so that's what I'm doing. And the whole time, I'm just trying to do the best I can with what I know. There's not a playbook for life. I mean, for some there is. But for me, I wasn't given a playbook. I was given a set of guidelines and a set of rules by my parents, by my community and stuff like that. Yeah. But I did deal on some of the hard stuff.
To deal with the specifics as they come up, that's a different story.
Right? I was doing the best I could with what I had. And I can tell you now that this wasn't the right way to do it. So I get it all back. And I get a job at Channel 5. And for a while, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. They're believing in me. And everything seems to be good.
But had anything really changed in your ability to deal with stress? Like, had you found a new way to do it?
No.
That, like, you hadn't investigated a new way to...
No. Yeah. No, I just found a new place to play. Mm-hmm. And I found new people to surround myself with.
And this came after the divorce?
After the divorce, yeah. And after losing the job at Channel 2.
Yeah.
And so I was doing good, and everything seemed to be going swimmingly. Mm-hmm. And everything was cool.
Well, this is kind of Casey 3.0, because you'd had the radio version, you'd had TV, and now we're on to – but like you – one of the things I want to ask you, I want to know your opinion, is you had mentioned earlier, you know, we grow up and we mature. But do you think there were parts of you that didn't really mature because you didn't have the – tools to do the self-introspection? You were drinking instead of,
without a doubt,
instead of growing that part of you. You know, we get older, but do we get wiser? And I think wisdom comes with that self-introspection and change, right?
And I never did really self-introspection. I didn't do much of that. I'd spent 20 years in an industry that I was applauded for just being me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
And they maybe didn't really want you to mature.
Maybe not want me to mature, or I'd like to think, and I know for KSL, had I come to them and said, "Hey, listen, I know on the outside I'm doing all right, but inside I'm drowning."
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't know what to do, and you know, and I think there's people here and there's people around that saw cracks, but I would tell them I'm okay. I'm fine.
Yeah.
If I ever say I'm fine again to my mom, she is going to lose it.
Yeah.
Because she'd always come up to me and say that. And I go, it's fine. It's fine. And I would say that just to appease you, to get you off my back, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to sit there and do the self-introspection. I didn't want you to tell me what's wrong with me, because you don't know me. You don't know what it's like. You don't know what this pressure's like. You can know.
Well, and there's also what you've already said in this episode is it's hard to explain how there is pressure and difficulty in a job where everyone thinks you're just having fun all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, boo-hoo. You know, you get free food. You get to go to concerts. You know, you get to ride lagoon rides for free. Yeah,
you get run over by a bull.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, good times.
But there's that kind of stuff. And so, you know, towards the end, you know, I'm doing my job in the morning, and then I'm going home, and I'm sitting alone on my deck drinking beer.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know, and I don't know what to do.
And this became a daily habit?
Daily, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, at first you do it just because you want to get out of that negative space in your head. And then it numbs it for a while. And then you wake up in the morning and you go, okay, I'm not going to do that again. And then you go do your job. And then you sit around and you go, man. And the next thing, you know, before you know it, you've got a beer in your hand and you're doing it. And it just becomes this vicious cycle. And you're going and you're going. And then next thing you know, you're on your back in a field with a wrecked truck looking up at sirens and wondering where your life went. Where did my life go? Tune into the next episode. Project Recovery. I am Casey Scott, your host. And that is Matt Woolley, your co-host, and you're a clinical psychologist.
That's right.
And we're talking about my story. Now, in the first episode, we kind of talked about my career, my persona, and the beginning. And
everything, you know, how you got started in radio, kind of. To be honest, I think you were a little embarrassed to share some of the stressors of your job, because most people look, I think, at people who work in the media, especially if you're on camera or on air, as, oh, you're just having fun playing around. But we talked about how that's real work. There's a lot of prep that goes into it. And there's a lot of pressure to be that persona, like you said, all the time.
And so we ended with me wrecking my truck, wrecking a car, blood on my face, me lying down on a field looking up at the sky.
Now, did you get thrown from the vehicle?
No, I was in. I had my seatbelt on, luckily. Okay. They pulled me out of the car. They said, lay down. I said, no, I'm good. I want to make sure everyone's all right. They said, no, I think it's best if you lay down.
Who's saying this to you?
Just people that pulled me out.
Just the people that helped, to help.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so then I'm lying down on the ground. I'm staring up at the sky. Sirens are going. People are crying. Blood is everywhere. And in that moment, you know, a lot of times you hear people talk about your life flashing before your eyes. But at that point, my life flashed before my eyes. I mean, everything I worked so hard for, family, my kids, you know, everything, just I just sat there and it was just despair. I mean, I didn't know how I had come to this point in my life.
Because you knew you were going to be in trouble.
And it wasn't so much the trouble. It was more the feeling of, how did it get this bad? How did I go from, you know, being married with three kids, TV, good, you know, to lying on my back and realizing that it all could be gone.
Okay, yeah.
In a flash.
And I think that's what people mean when they say their life flashed before their eyes. Whatever happened in that moment of realization makes you consider all those things.
You know, and not knowing what the outcome was going to be, where my life was going to go. I mean, it was a real pivotal point right there in that. You know what I mean? I mean, I could have killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I could be in jail for the rest of my life. I could be talking to my kids through bars through the rest of my life. And I'm not, it's a split second, but all of that, just like a tidal wave, flush just right over your brain. And,
sure.
and you go, oh my, I have no control. I don't know what to do. I mean, I'm scared. I mean, so scared that I can't even cry. And just, I mean, it's utter shock.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pull me out of the car. The ambulance comes. They take me to the hospital. They stitch up my head. I'm talking to police officers. They're talking back to me. I'm just, and I don't know what to do.
And did that all seem to happen in kind of a whirlwind of events by the time you got to the hospital with the ambulance, or did it seem to take a long time?
Both, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought you'd say.
You know what I mean? I mean, I can look back and I can remember, you know, key points of it, and then I can look back and it just all seems to be a blur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's stuff that's just etched into my brain that I'll never forget,
mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But, I mean, there I am. I'm in the hospital. There's two guards watching the door, and I know my life's going to be forever changed at this moment. It's one of those things that this is a crossroad.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably you'd had no experience quite like that before.
None whatsoever. And the thing is there's some things that I know that I can control, and there's a lot of other things that I have no idea what's going to happen. I don't know the outcome. I don't know how the rest of this is going to lay out. And I just know at that point the life I was living was not the life I wanted.
Yeah.
And so – and I remember making that decision right there in that moment going, I do not have control over what's going on right now. I do not like this feeling. And if I do get another chance, I do not want this.
So you thought – you had that level, that heavy level of epiphany or realization right there in the hospital?
Right there. I mean, yeah, sitting in there, you know, handcuffed to the hospital bed, two cops sitting there, and, you know, I could see my reflection off of the napkin dispenser that was hanging on the wall, like the paper towel.
Yeah, paper towel.
You know, and I've got stitches in my forehead. I'm puffy. I'm just looking at myself going,
yeah,
who is that guy?
Oh, that's a pretty sobering, so to speak, moment to look at yourself and realize, man, who have I become?
But the craziest thing is, man, is that I looked at it and I didn't recognize that guy. And I didn't want to be that guy. I mean, I'm just looking at it going,
what do you mean you didn't recognize that guy? Tell us more about that.
Because you're good at lying to yourself. You're good, you know, when you're in your addiction and you're drunk, you're good at lying to yourself. You're good at telling you reasons why you should be doing this or why it's okay, you know, and then you start to believe it. And then you start to think you're fooling everybody. In reality, you're not fooling everybody. But all of a sudden, you get a sober moment and you look in that and you go,
so you see who you've really become as opposed to the lie that you're telling yourself.
And I think what I saw was what a lot of people were seeing.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? And they would tell you that. I mean, people would say, hey, are you okay? And, yeah, I'm good. I got this. I'm Casey.
And they're asking because you're not looking like the Casey they used to know.
I'm not looking. I'm not acting. Mm-hmm. You know, and there were cracks in the dam. And, you know, people were trying to help me. But I was so good at, you know, convincing people that go, no, I'm okay. I got this. You know, I was just up all night. Had a panic attack. Coming up with excuses. But I looked at that and I was like,
those excuses ran out.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was just a sobering truth. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, my gosh, I do not want to be that guy.
Had you ever really had anything close to that before, that feeling?
No, because to be honest, I've always – and this is – liked myself. You know what I mean? I did. But
yeah.
At that point, there was not a redeeming quality about me. There was, I mean, no, and I mean, in that point, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, you could dissect it and go, no, you're still there. No, at that point, I looked in the mirror and I was like, no.
I've heard some people describe it as the self that they'd always been, that they still thought that they were, was fading, and that this other self, this unhealthy person in addiction, was kind of taking over. And it's in that moment, like you're describing, where they realize, I'm more that person than the person I used to be.
Yeah.
And that's a very, I would say, terrifying for a lot of people have told me. That's a terrifying moment.
No, I was terrified. I was in shock. I was scared. I didn't know what was going on. And so at that point, I decided I needed some help.
Now, let's pause just for a second, just for the listeners. You were intoxicated at the time of the accident,
yep.
And that was kind of part of your typical drinking on a daily basis routine. Well, can you tell us what happened to the passengers? Was it just one other car that was involved?
No, it was a family, and from what I understand, they're okay.
They're okay.
For what I know, I mean, and I say okay, and I mean, I.
There's multiple levels, right?
Yeah.
But physically, no one was killed.
No, yeah.
And as far as you know, no major injuries.
Yeah, as far as I know. Okay.
Obviously, when a person's involved in a car accident, it's very probable that they'll have, you know, what we call acute stress reaction, or maybe even some PTSD. But you know, emotionally, I'm sure it's scary for them. But physically, we know they're
yeah.
okay, for, as far as we know.
Yeah, and I use the term okay.
Yeah, well, loosely. I get that. Yeah,
yeah. Because I don't know.
Yeah. From what you've been told.
From what I've been told.
All right. I'm sure listeners were wondering.
Yeah. And it's a fair question. And that's one of the things that in rehab and I thank God. And every night I thought, what if?
Yeah. And I think that's what fuels some of these horrific self realizations like you're describing, is the realization that my irresponsible behavior could have ended or permanently ruined somebody's life.
You know,
could have ended a life, could have created permanent damage that can never be replaced. I mean, it's in those moments that really hits.
Yeah. And so, you know, so after that, the cops walk me out and, you know, I'm walking out of a hospital. I've got handcuffs on. I'm walking to the car. They put me in the car and then they take me to the jail. And I've got a golf shirt on. It's covered in blood. I've got stitches on my forehead. I mean, a lot of people have seen the mugshot.
Yeah.
And we go into the police station, and I say to them, I said, hey, you know, is there any way we cannot do a mugshot? And they said, why? And I said, well, I think it would just be better for everyone. And they said, no. And I was like, okay.
You know, that's not optional.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
But right.
I mean,
yeah.
I thought it would
– Never hurts to ask.
Yeah, I thought
I'd
give it a shot. So I get over there and I take the mug shot. And then they put me in the holding cell, and I'm sitting there in the holding cell. And they do the numbers, and they tell me what my bail is. And so I have my credit card on me, and so I bail myself out.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, all right, who's picking you up? And I said, well, I'll just get an Uber. And they said, well, no, you need someone physically to come get you. You've been drinking. We can't release you. You know, mm-hmm. they need somebody to sign for you. And when you go to jail, they take your cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you know this or if you – maybe you do because you're super smart. But nobody knows anybody's phone numbers anymore.
No, that's a huge problem.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And nobody's in a phone book.
Right.
And for
are
kids,
there still phone books?
That's what I was going to say. If there's kids out there, ask your parents what a phone book is. You know?
Exactly.
I used to just get the coupons in the back for Domino's.
Right.
you know?
That's what it was useful for.
Yeah, for coupons. Yeah. And I did know one person's number.
Yeah?
My ex-wife's.
Ah. And how long had you been divorced at that time?
2 years.
Just about 2 years. Huh?
Just about 2 years.
Yeah. So and pretty fresh still.
Pretty fresh. Alcohol was a major problem in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, that's not, you know.
So you're probably racking your brain trying to come up with somebody else's number, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so said, how long will I have to stay here? And they said, well, it'll be 24 hours. Now, I don't know if you've ever spent a night in jail. You don't have to answer that question.
I have not.
Yeah, and not fun.
I can't imagine it is.
You know, especially.
What was it? Describe it for those of us that haven't.
I mean,
what was the facility
you go
like?
In there, and it's cement walls and cement benches.
Because I think most of us know that just from television shows, and who knows if that's accurate. But it sounds like
I mean,
bars and everything?
Yeah, but I was in more of a holding cell with kind of a plexiglass thing and mm-hmm. then a bank of phones. And I said, 24 hours, man, I don't think I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stood in front of the phone for about 15 minutes thinking, how am I going to do this? You know, this is, you know. I called her and, you know, hey, you've got a collect call from Casey Scott, you know, and she could hear it in my voice. And it says it's from the police station.
Yeah.
Will you accept the call? So I'm thinking, well, this is, you know.
You probably weren't certain she'd accept, right?
No, I mean, you know, and I wouldn't blame her if she said no.
Mm-hmm.
Let's let him stay. But she was kind enough to pick it up. And I said, I'm here. will you come get me, please? And she says, yeah, I'll be right there. So she comes and signs me out, and I walk out of the police station. Once again, golf shirt drenched in blood, stitches on my forehead, and I see her, and I just started crying. Niagara Falls, tears coming.
Yeah.
She's crying. Now, she could have, you know, been mad, which I'm sure she was, but she gave me a hug, and we got in the car, and it took us about 15 minutes to get back to my house. And I just sat there crying and pulled up to my house, and I got out and she got out, and I said, so I'm sorry, I need help, and I'm going to get it, and I'm going to be the ex-husband you deserve, and I'm going to be the dad to the kids that they deserve. I said, I don't know where this is going to go, but I am going to fix this to the best of my ability. And she said, I think you can do it. I've seen you do some amazing things. And she gave me a hug, and I gave her a hug, and I went inside, and I just, my dog came and put his head in my lap, and I just started crying. I mean, more tears than, you know, I ever thought possible. And I didn't turn the TV on, which I normally do, just sat there in silence and said, what am I going to do? And I called a friend, and she told me about this place called Uni.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, I think you should give them a call.
University of Utah Neuropsychiatric Institute.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a detox center.
Well, it's a full service psychiatric hospital with a detox center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I called this detox center and I said, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what's going on, but I need help. And they says, okay. Do you have insurance? And I said, yeah, I got insurance. I said, I'd really like to come tonight if at all possible. And they said, well, I mean, it was this by this time it was after 5 o'clock. And they said, well, we can't run it through the billing. They said, if you come tonight, it's going to cost you about $3,500. And we don't know if you'll be able to get that back. If you can wait till tomorrow, insurance will cover it and it'll be a lot cheaper. And I says, okay, I think I can wait till tomorrow. What time do you guys open? They said, well, we open at 7, but we won't be ready until about 9. And I said, well, I'll be there at 7. And they said, well, you really don't need to because we can't do it till 9. I said, I'll be there at 7.
Yeah.
So I hung up the phone and I sat there and I sat there and I probably sat there for 2 hours just in a daze trying to figure out what had happened. And then about 9:30, my front door swings open. My mom, my brothers, their wives and their girlfriends come busting in.
Oh.
And they were ready to do like a intervention.
And how did they, had you talked to them?
Yeah, I talked to them, okay. You know, because I, you know, I wanted to give them a heads up, you know, that this was going to come out. I mean, I knew me being on the news and this happening. I mean, I've seen it before.
Yeah.
I,
it's going to make headlines.
Yeah. You know, and I wanted to give everybody a heads up as possible. And so they come flying in and they're ready for an intervention. I mean, my little brother, who's gigantic, you know, I mean, he's puffed up, you know, he's ready. He's got his letter. He's got his speech, you know.
Yeah.
We're ready to do this, you know.
Some serious, you know, love coming your way,
yeah,
right?
You know, yeah. He was going to give me the tough love. My mom was going to cry. My older brother was going to try to be the voice of reason.
Mom's crying is the worst.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Out of all that.
Yeah, you know. And so they came in and they were ready to do it. And I said, I've already called. I said, what? I said, yeah, I've already called. I'm going. So we didn't have the intervention. And then we went right to the hug and everybody crying.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is that after that, they all left. You know?
They're like, you're good?
But it was a cold truth. I mean, they had to get back to their families and their kids. And, you know, so I sat there and I said, okay. My mom says, I'll come pick you up in the morning. I said, all right. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk about that coming up next. So the next morning, I can't sleep. I'm in my head all night. I'm having panic attacks. I'm getting out of bed. I'm going to the mirror. I'm looking in the mirror. I'm going back to bed. I'm drinking water. I'm splashing it on. And I'm just in a full-blown panic attack.
Well, what are you going to look in the mirror for?
To see if I'm still there, I guess. You know, I mean, I really – I don't know. You know,
just kind of checking in with yourself a little bit.
You know, and you know, I'd look at the scar and I'd look at my face, and it was kind of one of these things. It's like, how did it get to this? Mm-hmm. You know, and then you know, I'm starting to think, well, maybe do I need this detox? Yes, I need this detox. But you start to have an inner battle. It goes back and forth, you know, and then you start to your brain starts working.
That voice of like justification that's kept you drinking all this time is coming out. Huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, and so, but I mean, I know I need help. You know what I mean? But that's not to say that this other part of my brain was like, oh, are you sure? You know?
Yeah.
Or I was, you know, wake up and go, man, please let this be just a nightmare. You know, and maybe that's why I'd go look in the mirror. I don't know. And so it's about 4:30 in the morning and I pick up the phone and I call my mom and she's up because I'm sure she was up all night, you know. And I said, hey, come get me. And she goes, well, they said they're not going to be there till 7. I said, Mom, I can't. You know, but one thing I knew is I didn't want to sit there in front of my mom because I didn't want to sit in front of somebody who I just let down and have to explain my feelings and do all this. I said, let's just go. And so I called Uni and they said, hey, listen, we're not going to be ready till noon. And I said, hey, look, this is not going to work for me. This is not going to work. Uh-huh. I need help and I need in. I said, I'll be there and just sit there. And whenever you get me in, get me in.
Yeah.
And so they take me down and my mom shows up there. We go in there. And then to get into Uni, you've got to be completely sober. I mean, they bring out a breathalyzer. You have to blow.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and they say coming off alcohol is one of the worst ones to come off of. People actually die from it. And so
that's true.
We've got to check your blood. We've got to do all this stuff. We got to, you know, because we're assuming the responsibility for you.
And you're going to have to give consent for treatment and you have to be sober to do that.
Oh, do you?
Well, yeah. Otherwise, you know, it causes problems with somebody saying, well, I wasn't in my right mind and all that.
And so they asked me and I said yes and I blew and it was, you know, zero and I was ready to go. And I go in there and I say goodbye to my mom. And at this point, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know what a detox center is. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the news is going on. I had called KSL and said, hey, give them heads up going, hey, this is what happened.
Yeah.
Just to let you know, I don't want you guys to be taken off guard of this and, you know, did that. And so I'm in there and I walk in and they take my belt and I go, what do you take my belt for? And they go, it's just a precaution. And then they take my shoes and my shoelaces and for the same reason, precaution. They give me some scrubs and no-slip socks. I guess that's a big thing.
Yeah,
I find out later in rehab, people are like, oh, they got good no-slip socks. And so Uni's got good no-slip socks. Uh-huh. And they're basically the same socks you use at Get Air, Get Out Air.
You got to be known for something.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you go in there, and then they put you on some drugs to get you off alcohol. And my breathing got really low, and I ended up going into the ER because they were worried about me. And so there was a lot of this. And about the third day, you start to come around. And I'm like, hey, so what's going on? And they're like, well, you got 4 more days. And I go, 7 days, huh? And they go, yeah. And I was like, okay. And so, you know, during that time, you know, the first couple of days, a lot of days, time sleeping and the medicine and all that. And then they start to
Were you under the impression it would be shorter than 7 days?
I guess I didn't know.
Well, and that's kind of why I ask. I don't think most people would ever consider the answers to these questions because until you're in the moment.
Yeah. Right, I mean, I'm
just curious what you thought.
7 days just seems long, but then again, I've never done this before, so maybe that's standard, you know?
Yeah.
And so I do that, and then the third day they start to integrate you into, you know, the kind of a pod life where there's other people there, and so then you start talking to people and, you know, you hear their story and this, and then they take you to – I went to my first AA meeting in Uni and got a chip. Then you have art classes and, you know, other classes that just to kind of
– So we call those kind of supportive therapies, you know, art and music therapy, right? It gives you a chance to – actually have some creative time, which is helpful in the recovery process and keeps your mind busy in more of a creative, positively stimulated way as opposed to just sitting, which is awful.
And so we're doing that and I'm talking to people and, you know, I'm keeping my head down. I am, you know, I'm just trying to get through it, you know, and so I do that. And then about the third or fourth day, my therapist, because they give you a therapist in there to talk to, goes, hey, we've got a couple people here from some different rehab centers. Would you like to talk to them? And at this point, I want to talk to anybody. You know, I mean, I don't want to be alone in my head anymore, you know, because that's just a beating going on.
You've done
on.
Enough arts and crafts.
Yeah. And I'm not very arty or crafty.
Yeah.
And so I go talk to this one guy, and he's from a rehab center. And, you know, he seemed like a nice guy, but I didn't get like a real cool vibe. I don't even know the name or I would say it. And then I talked to this young girl, and she was cool. And she had just a cool vibe about her.
So tell us what you mean by that. Like the one guy wasn't cool, and then she had a cool vibe. Like
well, so
what you're doing here is you're connecting and not connecting. But tell us like how so, that
so
feeling
the,
is.
So the guy was very matter of fact.
Okay.
This is what it is. This is what we do.
Just the facts, man.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, kind of, I guess, clinical,
mm-hmm.
for a better, lack of a better term.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is what we do.
I do.
This is what we, yeah, this is what we can offer you.
Yeah.
And the lady that came in, she was just this, she had a cool aura, a cool vibe. And I mean, right off the bat, you know, was more like.
More personable, maybe.
How are you doing?
Yeah.
Are you
yeah.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me talk to you and find out about you before I jump into the hard sell of why I'm here.
Okay.
You know, and we talked, and then she started telling me about the Pinnacle Recovery Center.
So she was from there.
She was from Pinnacle Recovery mm-hmm. Center. And she goes, this place is it's beautiful, you know, and everything she said turned out to be correct. I mean, from talking from the facilities to the staff.
And they weren't lacking any of that clinical stuff.
No. Okay. No. They had all the clinical stuff. And mm-hmm. I was like, I don't even know. I wasn't even thinking about going to a rehab. I mean, this was all new. I just knew that I needed to do something different.
Did you have the sense that 7 days wouldn't be enough ultimately?
No. At this point, I just given myself over to the system.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I was like
feeling kind of powerless.
Yeah, I was powerless. Yeah. And trust me, when I say I tried to stop drinking and tried to do all these things and fix myself, I tried. I mean, I really, really tried every day over and over again. And I used to say to my mom or my brothers or people that would give me guff, and I would say, hey, you know, some days I win, some days I lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like towards the end, definitely I was losing more days than I was winning.
Because I don't think you brought this up. In part one of this story, but you feel like you had tried on your own in years past to stop drinking?
Yeah. And sometimes I did very well. You know, there was a good span of time that I would drink once a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
social drinking.
Yeah, sort of you thing. Know, and then towards the end, I wasn't social drinking. I was drinking to forget my problems, to get out of my head,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just to forget. And so, you know, so I was losing a lot more than I was winning.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of turned myself over to the whole system and said, let's see where this goes.
Yeah.
You know, because what I'm doing is not working. So let's see what these guys have to offer. So she told me about Pinnacle Recovery Center. And I called my mom and I said, you know, this is what it is. This is what it costs. I don't have any money. I don't know what my insurance is going to cover. I don't know any of this. But do me a favor, Mom. Will you go tour the facility?
Oh, yeah.
Go take a look at it, you know.
Uh-huh.
See if what they're selling is what they have.
Yeah.
And so my mom, and bless her, she went there. She walked around and looked at it and asked some questions and then called me back and says, yeah, Case, I think you'll like it. And I think it's a good idea if you do it.
Mom approved.
Yeah. And I said, you know, this is going to mean everyone's going to have to step up. And I feel like I can't ask that of them. And she goes,
what do you mean everybody's got to step up?
I've got three dogs. I've got three kids. I've got an ex-wife. I've got a mortgage. I've got all these things,
yeah.
that, you know, that still need to be managed and still need.
I think that's hard for people to, you know, if you think about yourself, the listener, and all of a sudden you had to go, you know, check out of life for 45 days, no income, you know, how would you handle that? That's tough.
Yeah, you know, but
and I think a reason why a lot of people don't do this.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know, and my mom and had talked to my brothers and my dad. And so they all agreed. They said, Casey needs this. And so they band together and they, you know, my aunt took my bulldog. My dad took one dog. My mom took a dog. My ex-wife stepped up and took the kids full time because I had 50-50 custody.
Kudos to her for all her help, right?
And I still got 50-50 custody. Mm-hmm. And so they said, we need this. And so I checked in. And when I got there, I walked in and I was surprised. And it was everything they said it was. I mean, it was a beautiful home. It was, you know, it was everything that she told me it was going to be.
And it had been originally had been someone's home.
No, it was built
for this.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's right next to the Cotton Bottom.
Oh, okay.
Up in Cottonwood, Pinnacle mm-hmm. Recovery. And it was two lots. They tore it down, built this beautiful home. It's got a volleyball court, a river running through the back of it.
That's a beautiful place.
Yeah, I mean, gorgeous, you know. And so I checked in.
Why is that important to you? You keep mentioning that, like, it felt like, you know, why is that important? Why not just a cinder block building?
So when you're in recovery, there's a lot of self-introspection and there's a lot of what they call processing. And processing is you sit down with 15 other addicts and you talk about stuff. And one point I was talking and I was saying I was going to go to wherever they sent me. And it didn't matter if it was white walls and two dudes in white jackets just watching me. And he goes, you're still going to go? And I was like, yeah, because I know I needed it, you know. But to find out it was a nice place and it was comfortable and had a home vibe, I think that really helps with your mental stability to know that it's, hey, that, you know, okay.
Yeah. That does. It has a positive emotional impact for people.
Yeah. And so we move in there. I move in there and I get a roommate and I start going through the program. And Pinnacle Recovery is unique to me. And I can only say this because I've only been to one rehab. Now, there was people in there that had been to four or five different ones. And they would talk shop and they would say, this one's good, this one's bad, these, you know, and all this stuff. So I can only talk about Pinnacle Recovery because that's the only rehab that I've ever done.
Yeah.
And so I go there and they were good in the fact that they threw a bunch of stuff at us. Now, we were in meetings from 8:30 in the morning until 9:30 at night. We do meditation. We do 12-step. We do yoga. We do working out. We'd go to lunch and, you know, you'd sit down and read in your journal and you'd write down positive affirmations. And so you were nonstop going all the time.
So that's what you mean by they threw a lot of stuff at you.
Yeah. And it was kind of, for me, like an a la carte. It was like, oh, I this one makes sense to me. I'm going to try to implement this in my life. This one, it doesn't seem like it's my deal. Mm-hmm. I'm going to shy away from that one. Not to say that that doesn't work for somebody else, but it just doesn't seem to work with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, we went to healing circles. We had some lady banging on a drum, blowing sage in your face, you know. Mm. And it was just a bunch of stuff. And it was mindfulness. And it was positive. And so I did it. I was there for 45 days.
Yeah.
And one day my therapist goes, how come you haven't asked? And I go, asked what? And he goes, how long are you going to be here? Because once you get into it, there'll be certain people going, I'm only here for 30 days. And that's because that's all their insurance is going to cover or that's all their work let them off for. And I knew that I wanted to be in there until they felt like I was okay to walk out and have the tools on me that I could use to get through this and to work towards recovery. And I said, well, I've never asked because I thought you guys would tell me. Mm-hmm. You know, if you see a finish line, you'll either push harder or you might lighten up a little bit because you can see it. I said, I didn't want to go into it like that. I just thought you guys would say, when you're ready, you'll let me go. And so, you know, throughout the thing, people said, you know, are you a 12-step guy? No, I'm not a 12-step guy. I think there's a place for 12-step, and I think a lot of people like that.
The traditional AA, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous sort of 12-step type programs.
Yeah. And I really like the mindfulness and the breathing and the being present. And that's what I've been focusing my energy on. And so that's been working for me. And I've, you know, out and about because I've been out now, you know, close to 6 months. People come up to me and go, so you're never drinking again. And I can honestly tell you, I can't tell you that because I don't know the future. I can tell you I'm not drinking right now because that works for me. Uh-huh. You know, and I'll see the look on some people's face and they go, I don't know how you can't just tell me you're not drinking ever again. And I go, because in my head, I can't tell you the future. And if I do tell you that I'm never drinking again, and by chance if something happened and I did, I know I let you down again. But I can tell you right now that I'm not drinking.
Now, I think that makes some people nervous, but it seems like you find a sense of calm in that. Why is that?
Because I don't want to lie to anybody. You know what I mean? And then that's the truth. I don't want to lie to you. I don't want to tell you never and then do that and see the look on your face. But if I tell you right now that I'm not, there's no lie. Mm-hmm. And I know 100% that I'm not. So I'm being truthful. I'm being authentic. And I'm being me.
Yeah. And I think in our conversations off air, that fits with kind of how you talk about it. And I think it also fits with what you really connected with, which is a meditative mindfulness, be in the moment type of recovery program.
Yeah. I can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. You know what I mean? But if I tell you one thing and it doesn't, you're going to come back to me and go, well, you told me you didn't. And I wanted to tell you, I'm not sure because I can't predict the future, but you wanted an answer. So I had to choose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this way, it keeps me from doing that and messing myself up in my head. And if I go, listen, I'm not doing it right now, and mm-hmm. I don't have any plans to, I can tell you right now with 100% that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I know it, and that's my truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear a lot of people in recovery talk about my truth. That's my truth.
What's true to them.
What's true to them.
Okay.
And you'll also hear a lot of people in recovery talk about my recovery.
Mm.
And a lot of people will put a blanket on recovery going, well, this is recovery. Mm-hmm. Well, that's recovery as a whole, but mm-hmm. my recovery is unique to me. It's the way I do it. We had this one thing where we were in a group, and this lady's banging on this elk drum, and she's blowing sage in this kid's face. And she said, every morning you got to wake up and you got to take your water out to a stream, and you got to bless it to the east, the west, the north, and the south. And I'm sitting in my head going, this sounds absolutely crazy. I can't believe that this is what they're telling us, okay?
Yeah.
And so I go to bed. I wake up the next morning, and I walk down to the kitchen, and I look out, and there's a member of the house out there with his water, holding up the east, holding up to the west, holding up to the north, holding up to the south.
Okay.
And he's doing it.
Yeah.
And he was coming in. And in my head, the first thing that I said, like, I'm going to light this kid up. You know?
But then give him a hard time. Is that what you mean? Give him a hard time.
Yeah. You know, but then he walked in. And he seemed calm. And I said, who am I to take that away from him? If that works for him, that works for him. And so that's what I want to talk about on this podcast is what works for you, works for you. If it's working, then let it work.
And was that kind of an insightful moment where you realized that's how this can work? Like for some people, they might do something that seems totally nuts to you that you don't connect with at all, but you realize that it works for them and then vice versa, right?
And I learned that pretty early on because we'd go to 12-step and a lot of people come back and you could see it in the house. I mean, there was guys who were like, hey, we're 12-step. We're all 12-step, you know, and there'd be three or four because people would go, well, let's go to a different meeting. Or we'd go to Cocaine Anonymous meeting or we'd go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting or we'd go to a healing circle or we went to one that all they did was did chants. You know, and that's what I liked about it is because every time we went there was someone in the house that goes,
okay, so you could see them connect with these different what we call treatment modalities or different types of treatment.
And they would go, that makes sense to me.
Uh-huh.
And that works. And so who am I? What gives me the power to take that away from you? And why would I make fun of it? If I know myself what I'm battling, why would I make some fun of something that's going to work for you? So I didn't say anything.
Because you're usually pretty good at lighting people up.
Yeah. I mean, I've made a career out of it. You know what I mean?
Being able
to say that stuff.
I've been on the other end of it.
Yeah, and be quick at it. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. If that's working for him, then don't open your mouth.
That's huge. That's growth right there, right?
Just let it work for him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people like I've had a lot of people Facebook me and ask me, hey, you know, what are you doing? And I go, well, this is what I'm doing. This is what's working for me. You know.
Oh, they're asking what you're doing in your recovery.
Yeah,
how are you staying sober?
Moms, kids. I mean, if anyone Facebooks me and wants to talk, I feel like I'm obligated to give it back. And so I'll call them.
And you're in a unique position to share those things with people.
Yeah. And so I talk to them and I go, but mind you, this works for me. I'm not saying it's going to work for you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you that this is why I like it and this is why it works for me. And if it doesn't make sense to you, I understand and I can see why, but I'm sorry, but it works for me.
Is that different than, I mean, it's hard to remember now maybe, but you know, if you go back to all before all of this happened and you knew whatever the general person knows about alcohol recovery, were you surprised that there were all these different options or did you think of it just purely kind of in a 12-step?
I just thought of it as a 12-step.
Yeah.
You know,
I think
I mean?
That's what most people think is that recovering from a substance, especially alcohol, you go through the 12 steps and nowadays, there's a lot of research to back it up that supports what you're saying, which is people have better recovery. They have longer term outcomes if they connect with the treatment modality. So it's not to say that 12 steps isn't great, because it is great for a lot of people, and you saw that. But there are other things out there that a person may connect with.
But, you know, and the weird thing is, a lot of times the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing when it comes to treatment and recovery. And I say that because the first time I'm in uni, I'm down there in a 12-step meeting. I get my chip. I have to stand up and say, my name is Casey Scott. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I go to another meeting and they go, you don't have to say your name is Casey Scott. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic. Why would you highlight the worst thing you think about you?
That's a totally different mindset,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Approach,
yeah,
to,
they go,
to treatment.
Well, you know, is that what you want to lead with every time you talk to somebody?
Yeah.
And for some people that works because it keeps them honest. But mm-hmm. for me, I think that there's value in the 12-step rooms. But I don't want to hang – and I'm not saying – I don't want to hang out in 12-step rooms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I want this to be a chapter in my life, a very important chapter, but I want to move on and do good and get my life back to where I want it to be.
Well, I think our success in life as humans has a lot more to do with the goodness of fit between us and something else than it does about the individual parts, a person and his or her job, his or her relationship, and in this case, his or her recovery.
Yeah. And so that's all I'm doing right now, is trying to be the best me possible. And one of the important things when you're going through the recovery is giving it back, because there were some dark times. There were some bad times where people you didn't know were there to give you help, to give you a hand up, to be a ear, just to listen to you. And so you want to give back, because you don't know what somebody's going through unless you've gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. It's hard to relate. I mean, I had so many people go, why don't you just quit drinking? Well, yeah, okay. Yep. I mean, yeah. That
would be a solution.
Yeah, that would be an A solution.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's just like, what, giving up Diet Coke, giving up hamburgers,
yeah,
giving up your TV. I mean, what you need to do is figure out why you're addicted, what hole this is filling for you, and then that's what works for me. I'm not saying that's going to work for everybody, but I want this podcast to be around to let everybody know that there is a bunch of different stuff out there. There's not just one way up this mountain.
Yeah, and I'm when you first came to me and talked to me about doing this, I was excited about that for that same reason, and that is that a lot of people have one point of view on what addiction is. Number one, am I really addicted? A lot of people don't believe they are. And number two, what can we do about it? So a lot of people look at a 12-step program and think, great, that's going to work for me. But a lot of people, they're not so sure they want to, you know, call themselves an alcoholic and stand up there. And then they, unfortunately, if they don't know that there are other options available, a lot of those people just don't get any help. And of course, then there's a cycle. So my investment in this podcast is to help people understand, you know, what are addictions? We're going to talk about, of course, alcoholism and substance abuse and addiction, but we want to talk about a lot of other addictions that are maybe considered behavioral in nature, but are just as difficult to understand and to kick as maybe alcohol, and what are the options for all of the treatment. We want people to feel encouraged and uplifted that, hey, if I have something in my life that's holding me down, if I'm dependent or addicted, there are options for me.
And this isn't just for addicts as well. I mean, this is for family members.
Absolutely.
This is for anybody who knows somebody that might be addicted to something. And maybe you'll glean something from this. Maybe you'll go, hey, well, that makes sense. Or it might give you a different perspective on what somebody who has a real addiction is going through.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about your experience, but think about what you just – your story, your brother and your mom and your ex-wife, all these people that are love you, they didn't have any experience with this before. You know, they came in guns a-blazing, getting ready for some tough love with you. They didn't know where to take you or what to do either. So we want everybody, because you're going to have somebody in your life that you love and care about who's going to struggle with something like this, and we want you also to feel like you know what to do.
All right. So that was just a kind of cliff note version of my story. I'll be sharing more of my experiences, my wins, my losses throughout this whole recovery process. And it's going to be my job to be as honest with you as possible. And that's what you can expect from me.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here with you, Casey. This is, I think, great for you personally, just on a therapeutic level to be able to get out there and talk. You have the ability uniquely to reach a lot of people. And I'm excited to educate people along the way with you.
So if you know somebody who's suffering from some sort of addiction, have a conversation with them, please. See you next time.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at KSLPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.